You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Journalist and historian Daniel Okrin is fond of a quote attributed to Mark Twain. History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And that statement couldn't be more true in comparing the subject of Okrin's latest book, The Story of Immigration Restrictions in the Early 20th Century, with our current debate and rhetoric over immigration today. His book, The Guarded Gate, details a 30-year effort to restrict immigration of nationalities and ethnic groups that were deemed by its backers as not typically American. We're talking Southern and Eastern European Jews and Catholics. The effort was spearheaded by a group of Boston Brahmins, Northeastern aristocrats, in fact, notable names in our history, many notably progressive, Henry Cabot Lodge, Joe Lee, Madison Grant, the founder of the Bronx Zoo, Fairfield Osborne, the director of the American Museum of Natural History, and birth control advocate Margaret Sanger, to name a few. These restrictionists were aided by those involved in the new, quote, science, unquote, of eugenics, whose adherents argued that certain nationalities were inherently inferior. This provided an intellectual justification for restriction beyond mere prejudice or bias, and was the push needed to pass the Immigration Act of 1924, which established quotas for each nationality wishing to immigrate, which greatly favored Northern Europeans over other nationalities. Daniel Okrin was the first public editor of the New York Times and editor-at-large at Time magazine and managing editor of Life magazine. His books include Great Fortune, The Epic of Rockefeller Center, and Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. His new book is titled The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Daniel Okrin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
What interests you in writing about this particular era you write about in the Guarded Gate, this era from really the 1890s to the 1920s and the passage of the Immigration Act?
Well, it came out of my last book, really. My last book was a history of Prohibition called Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. And I was wallowing around in the years before Prohibition and during Prohibition itself and was particularly intrigued by the connection between Prohibition and a sort of a rampant xenophobia. The people who were fighting for Prohibition didn't like foreigners and wanted to keep them out of the country. And as out of that research, I stumbled across this eugenic angle and put that inside of some distant corner of my brain, and then when I was casting about for a new subject several years ago, then it just kind of popped forward again, particularly because of the immigration issues that are present in our lives today.
The beginning of the book describes a visit to Ellis Island with the Commissioner of Immigration in 1925. That's 1 year after the passage of the Immigration Act of 1924. And it defies any sort of description that we usually think of when we think of Ellis Island. What was it like then, and how did it contrast to the heyday of Ellis Island?
Well, the heyday of Ellis Island, it was, you know, among the busiest places in the world. There were, in some years, well over 1 million people coming in. There were individual days as many as 12,000 people arriving on barges from the transatlantic ships that were waiting in the harbor, long snaking lines to get through the immigration processing. There were hospitalization buildings. There were detention buildings. It was this incredibly bustling and at times kind of terrifying hive of activity. 1 year after the laws passed, it was like, you know, strolling down a summer lane with the birds chirping. Typical day, you would have, you know, 250, 300 people. There was no need for the large staffing. The hospital unit closed down. And as I say, as I describe in those opening pages, the people were different too. The crowds that had been coming in for the previous 20 years were very heavily from the poorer parts of Europe, from Eastern and Southern Europe, from Italy and from Poland and from Russia and Ukraine. And then those people were effectively barred by the 1924 law that I write about. And as the Commissioner of Immigration says, as he is showing some people around Ellis Island a year later, in the empty, placid, pastoral Ellis Island, he said, now the people who come here look like Americans, which says that those other people were not Americans. And the Americans that were coming in then were people from Northwestern Europe, from the favored countries of the UK, Scandinavia, the Netherlands, and it was a totally different world.
You know, American history, and you write about this at the beginning of the book, that how has been filled with these eras of anti-immigrant sentiments and actions many times, going all the way back to colonial era, where you have a wonderful quote by Benjamin Franklin decrying the immigrations of the Germans to Pennsylvania, So what was different about this time in 1890 to 1920 from these earlier eras? Each wave
sheer
of
numbers.
Yeah.
A couple of things that had happened that made the immigration, three things I'd say that had happened that made the immigration really spike up. One was the creation of a transcontinental railroad network in Europe. So people from a place like Romania, from Ukraine, from Russia, there was a way to get to a port where you could get a ship that would take you away. Before that, you know, everything would have to go by horse cart. There was no means of transportation to get you to the place where you get your eventual transportation. Also, there was a huge burst in population in Europe in the second half of the 19th century. It was getting crowded. Poverty was more and more pervasive. And then finally, in the Russian Empire, the anti-Semitic activities of the Tsarist regime beginning in 1882, which limited Jews to where they could live, occupations they couldn't engage in. There were pogroms. People were getting killed. It was a really terrifying time for the Jews of Eastern Europe, and they flooded out. So you have a very different kind of immigration, and you have a very different numbers of immigrants. You know, in a peak year, it could be well over a million people coming into the U.S. In the earlier days, it was 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 a year.
What about the American reaction to those events? I mean, every wave of immigrants sort of spawned this backlash. Irish in the 1840s and 50s, Germans in colonial days. So what was different about this in the American reaction? Was it the feeling that these people weren't, quote, American, unquote?
They were different. They were not from the places that Americans, that immigrant Americans had come from before. They were of a different nationality, different religion, very much so different languages. They also were impoverished by and large, of course, not exclusively. So beginning around the early 1890s, it's the development of the huge urban slums, particularly in the large cities of the East Coast. And these were fetid, disease-ridden areas plagued with horrible unemployment, people living 10, 12 people to a room. And this was for those who led the anti-immigration movement. This was right in front of their faces. They couldn't not see it. And they were, many of them, appalled by it. And it's interesting to me that Boston and New York, particularly, especially Boston, the people who were most appalled by it and who led the anti-immigration movement over the next 30 years, they were largely progressives in the 1900, 1910 term of the word. They believed in bettering the lives of people. They wanted to keep these people out.
Interesting. Well, the book begins all the way back in the 1850s, I believe, with Francis Galton, then later in his American counterpart, if you will, that sort of provides the intellectual underpinning for the Immigration Act of 1924, Francis Galton in the UK and Charles Davenport in the US. Tell us about these two men.
Francis Galton was a cousin of Charles Darwin's. He was a wealthy amateur scientist, but, a real scholar. He did some important and worthwhile work that lasted. But when Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, everything in science in Western Europe and then in the U.S., it kind of exploded. The world changed in a radical, radical way. Until then, what we now call the creationist view of the origins of mankind was everyone's view, virtually, in the Western world. But once you determine, as Darwin did, that we are not all derived from Adam and Eve, we are therefore not all related to each other, and some of us are better than others. And this is what Galton picked up on. He believed that there was a real genetic distinctions between individuals that would be passed along through sexual reproduction, and that one could control that. Now, he was right to a degree. Obviously, tall people have tall children, but he carried it a little too far. He even proposed, one idea he had was to get the 5,000 best young men and the 5,000 best young women in England and have them matched up in arranged marriages by the state, all of them to be married in a ceremony in Westminster Abbey, presided over by Queen Victoria. And then these couples would be given an annual stipend, a salary, so that they could get down to the real work that needed to be done, which was creating the next generation of Britons. I mean, it was really kind of nutty. That leaps the ocean and falls into the hands of Charles Davenport, a very distinguished animal geneticist and zoologist operating out of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island. And he takes these ideas and he begins to turn them in a different direction toward what might call negative eugenics, which is, it's not just let's breed the best to the best, but let's make certain that the worst, the least of us, are not breeding, because they're going to make create more problems for the country. And this gets transformed into another idea. It begins with Davenport, you know, let's keep out epileptics. Let's keep out those, as it was termed in the day, feeble-minded, the blind, the deaf, anybody with congenital disability. But then in 1916, a book is published called The Passing of the Great Race by a very wealthy New Yorker named Madison Grant. And he takes the anti-immigration idea and he weds it to the eugenic idea so that it's not a matter of keeping out individuals. Let's keep out nationalities because it is provably true that these nationalities are genetically inferior to the so-called true Americans. In fact, ironically, the term that they used to describe themselves, the anti-immigrationists, was Native Americans, rather different from the way we use the term today. There's a paragraph in Grant's book that really kind of gets to the essence of what the anti-immigrationists and eugenists were up to.
What was the evidence to show, quote, that they were provably different?
Well, at that point, there was none. There was a very eloquent, tightly argued, and vividly written piece of imagination on Grant's part. He identifies three races of Europe, the best, the finest, the tall, the blonde Nordics. Lesser than they are the Alpines. At the very bottom of the ladder are the short and swarthy, his terms, Mediterraneans. And he writes at one point, we know that the mating of any two races will eventually revert to the lower race. Now, how did we know that? I have no idea how we knew that because it was never true. But in his mind, it was true. And he said, therefore, if a Nordic marries an Alpine, the children will be Alpine. And if an Alpine marries a Mediterranean, the children will be Mediterraneans. And he writes, and the mating between any of the three European groups and a Jew is a Jew. And this kind of gets to the heart of it, this wish, I think, to find a reason to hate people and to want to keep them out of the country. And this changes the language of the anti-immigration movement, which had been flailing and not getting anywhere by their standards for over 20 years, and marries these two together. So it leads to Calvin Coolidge in 1921 writing an article right before he becomes vice president saying that now that biological laws have proven that these races are inferior, we must keep them out of the country.
Wow. I was struck by some of the, quote, evidence, unquote, that sort of proved this point in their minds. And they were things like tests where you take a recent immigrant and offer them a person that you would have to be very much a native-born American to know that person and say, who is this person? I mean,
right.
It was the most biased sort of intelligence tests that sort of was the evidence for this, wasn't it?
No, you're asking somebody who's been in the country for a few years, whose native language is not English, who maybe doesn't have access to media. There was really no mass media then, to answer a question as if it were, which of the following defines Rich Fisher? Is he a radio host, a baseball player, or a cartoonist? You know, and if you don't know Rich Fisher, you're stuck. And that was the nature of the questions that were offered on this test, and the results of which were used as the basis of policy.
My guest today is Daniel Okrent, a journalist and writer and author. His latest book is The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. It's published by Scribner. Well, take us back to the beginnings of the, as they call it, the restriction movement, the anti-immigration movement. At the time, it seemed like it was something you mentioned, it was led a lot by progressives, but it also transcended political and social ideologies of the day, where you have these two Boston Brahmin like Henry Cabot Lodge and Joe Lee, advocate for social development within the poorer classes in Boston, education efforts. Two men you wouldn't think that have a whole lot in common working together on this restriction movement.
The strange bedfellows were not that strange at core, which is to say it was a class distinction. Lee and Lodge disliked each other politically. They were at opposite ends of the spectrum, but they were the product of the same world, of the same upper-class world of the Boston Brahmins. Lee is a fascinating character. He was called the first citizen of Boston. He supported black churches in Boston, black schools in the South. He was a supporter of the Women's League for Peace and Freedom. By every standard, he was a progressive. He led the Boston School Committee for several years. One of the things that he did as the school commissioner, as it were, was making certain that the schools would be open at night so that the immigrants could learn English. And he made certain that there were doctors and dentists going into each school. Sounds like he loves the immigrants. But in fact, what he was expressing was this notion that once they're here, we have to civilize them because they're going to be sitting, living down the street from us. But let's keep them out if we can. And there are two particularly scary statements of his. One point he says, and it says to a friend in a letter, that soon, because of the Tsar's pogroms, soon Europe will be drained of all of its Jews, perhaps to its benefit, but not to ours. And at another moment, he said that he's engaged in immigration restriction because otherwise, he said, we'll become a Dago nation.
Yeah, and this is a person who was considered socially progressive. Another person that really struck me as it just blew my mind, Margaret Sanger, the birth control. She referred to birth controls and eugenics as the right and left hand of one body.
If you stop and think about it, there is something very similar between the two. They're not the same, of course, but both are playing in the field of planned reproduction. In Sanger's case, let's have less reproduction. In the eugenicist's case, let's have reproduction only by those people that we think merit the right to reproduce. She would make an alliance with anyone who was on her side, and she made real alliance with the eugenicists at various points. And the horrible slum conditions that we were talking about before, she deplored those, and she really wanted to bring birth control to the women in the slums so that they wouldn't have such large families that they couldn't support. But she advocated, and in her advocacy for it, she pointed out, isn't it terrible, all these people in the slums reproducing at these rates? So to accomplish her birth control ends, she used some pretty unsavory arguments.
Yeah. The beginnings of this movement, as we mentioned, it just starts literally as Ellis Island is really this place that we think of when we think of Ellis Island, thousands coming in each day. There was not a lot of success, even though there were bills put up as early as, I think, 1890, 91. And I can't remember if it's a source or you wrote that said, if the restriction movement had put a line between Europe and the rest of the world, this would have passed easily. But they put the line in the middle of Europe with Northern Europe free to immigrate, Southern Europe unable to immigrate to the United States.
The first law that passes Congress in 1895, introduced by Henry Cabot Lodge, is vetoed by Grover Cleveland. The second one, and every Congress after that, the law is reintroduced but never makes it to a final vote. Then it passes again in 1912, and it's vetoed by William Howard Taft. Passes again in 1914, vetoed by Woodrow Wilson. Passes again in 1917, vetoed again by Woodrow Wilson. And one of the reasons why this was happening is whatever their personal feelings were, Cleveland and Taft and Wilson were aware that the immigrants who had been coming in large numbers had votes. And it became a very sensitive political issue, particularly if you're trying to win votes in the large northeastern states, which were the largest in the country at the time, and were heavily occupied by recent immigrants. So the ability to say, as Wilson did, he said, all three of these presidents did, America is founded by immigrants. We are a nation of immigrants. We can't be arbitrary in the way we choose our immigrants. It all sounded really good. It sounded absolutely wonderful, but there was a political motive behind it. It changes when the eugenic idea is tied to the anti-immigration movement, because then it's not racism, it's not anti-Semitism or anti-Catholicism, it's science, and it provides the comfortable and appealing clothing that can hide the racism that had been inherent in much of the anti-immigration movement to that point, to such a degree that Coolidge was able to make his scientific statement, and various other political leaders in the early 1920s even stopped talking about what was wrong with people from specific countries, but just talked about the scientific issue, and then it became a question of how do we control it.
And how the Immigration Act of 1924 was implemented was at least as racist as the act itself, because they didn't use the most recent census figures. They went to a point where the deck was stacked in favor of people who looked, quote, American, unquote.
That's right. It's 1924, and they decide on a quota system. That's how they're going to control it. First, we're going to reduce the total number of immigrants allowed into the country to around, I think it was 160,000. And then those immigrants are going to be assigned slots by nation based on their percentage of the American population of the same ethnicity. So if immigrants from country A made up 10% of the American population, then immigrants from country A would get 10% of the immigration slots in any given year. But as you said, they didn't use the 1920 census, which was only 4 years old at the point, or the 1910 census, or the 1900 census. They used the 1890 census, very carefully chosen, because that was the year, that was the last census before the large immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe began. So what they were really doing, say, let's base the new immigration based on what was here before all of this immigration came in. So the 38 articles and some 20 pages of the 1924 Act, nowhere do you see the word Italy or Greece or Italians or Greeks or Jews or Poles. It's just quotas based on percentages, and each country will get a quota. And you know, it's not because we don't like these people, it's because they don't fit under the quota line.
It was really interesting reading a lot of very famous people saying really absolutely reprehensible things that you quote in the book when it comes to immigration during this time. You were talking about Francis Galton's idea of taking the 100 most eligible and beautiful representatives of England and having them mate in a ceremony officiated by Queen Victoria. Theodore Roosevelt saying something like that in, you know, he's making these quotes about the need for true Americans to have large families and talking about things like race suicide.
Yeah, race suicide was a term that he picked up from actually a socialist professor, very famous sociologist at the University of Wisconsin named Edward Ross. That if Americans, if the true Americans are not reproducing in large families, then we will soon be outnumbered by the immigrant families who are, in fact, are having many, many children. And Roosevelt said it was unpatriotic and un-American for a couple that had the physical capability to reproduce to not reproduce. And he wanted American families to have 4, 5, 6, 7 children. And I say American, we're all American families now, but he saw it as somewhat differently. He said that, you know, the people who come from our original colonial stock. Roosevelt was interesting. I mean, he goes back and forth at various times, but his general alliance with the eugenicists and the anti-immigrationists is undeniable.
It's interesting that as you compare the rhetoric today to the rhetoric of the 19-teens and 1920s, there's a lot of similarities in the way we're talking about Muslim immigrants and immigrants from Latin America.
Yeah. When you begin to characterize the qualification or the acceptability of an immigrant, not on who the immigrant is, but on the ethnic group or national group the immigrant belongs to, you're really getting close to what can only be described as racial or ethnic discrimination. So when we hear politicians say we can't have any more people from the Muslim countries coming in, well, what about the good people from the Muslim countries? What about the ones who would be great citizens, who would add to our economy and add to our knowledge and otherwise belong? You can't keep them out because you don't like their neighbors. Well, under this sort of thinking, you can keep them out, and I fear that that's something that's happening in this country now.
Of course, the practical implications of the Immigration Act of 1924 are very large, and also the movement that helped shape that act, eugenics. It's used by the Nazis extensively that you write about in the book. And, of course, as the Nazis come to power, it has tragic implications for Jews trying to escape to a safe area.
Obviously, if you have 95,000 Jews from Eastern Europe coming in every year and that number is reduced to 7,000, 8,000 in a given year because of the quota, how many who would have come were unable to come and were instead killed by the Nazis? And it applies as well to the, you know, there were 350,000 Greeks who were starved to death by the Nazis. There were 200,000 to 250,000 Serbs who were killed by Nazi death squads. The desperate poverty of southern Italy in the years between the wars, the number of Italians who would have come but instead had to live these horrible, horrible, constricted lives ruined by desperate poverty. There were real consequences to this law, which stayed in place for 41 years, 1924 to 1965. You know, at one point in 1939, there was a bill introduced into Congress specifically to allow in 20,000 German Jewish children outside of the quota, and it was defeated. It didn't get passed. And at the time, Franklin Roosevelt's first cousin, a woman named Laura Hodling, whose husband happened to be the Commissioner of Immigration, she dismissed this. She said, 20,000 charming little children will grow up to be 20,000 ugly adults. And We don't know what happened to those individual children, but we can guess.
It's very interesting. You know, there was in World War II, there was a very famous poster for enlisting in the armed forces. It originally was done by Charles Landecker for the First World War. It was resurrected in the Second World War, and it had a list of names, and it was every immigrant group that you might imagine, many of them from the same immigrant groups that were affected by the Immigration Act of 1924. It was almost like, we don't want you here, but now that you're here, you have to go fight.
Right. Yeah. This is, you know, the famous in Hollywood, the World War II bomber
right.
crew, where one
right.
guy's name was O'Hara, and the next guy was Goldberg, and the next guy was Kowalski. And, you know, it was.
And then there'd be an Italian name as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. DiMaggio.
Yeah.
You know, showing us that we are the nation of immigrants. But at the very same time that was being shown, we were keeping immigrants out. The only real change in immigration law because of World War II happens around 1943 because of our alliance with Chiang Kai-shek's Chinese. The old 1882 Chinese Restriction Act, which was absolutely, you know, an absolute ban on the immigration of Chinese, suddenly that changes. Chinese can come in because they're our allies. But for the Eastern and Southern Europeans, it doesn't change until 1965.
So as you're writing this book and you're watching the Trump administration take action to limit immigration in all sorts of ways, as they have been doing during the administration, what was your thought process as you're writing this book?
Well, you try when you write history not to think about the present, but you fail. I was determined that my book was going to be about the passage of this law and the effects of this law. And it really ends at the beginning of World War II, when, by which time, the eugenic movement in the U.S. is all but dead because it was so discredited by the horrible policies, the euthanasia policies, particularly of the Nazis, and the organizations that had supported it, Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Institution, American Museum of Natural History. They withdrew from it as if it were a hot coals. They had to get away from it. My ability to keep the current controversy out of my head was sorely strained on a daily basis. And every sentence you write, you're thinking about what's going on today. It's inescapable. My last book, which is about prohibition, I remember when I went on tour to promote that, everybody was asking me, said, well, what does this tell us about marijuana prohibition? So I said, well, I'm just writing about what happened then. But in fact, when you're writing history, you're writing about today as well. Mark Twain says history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. And in this particular case, the anti-immigration fervor of the first quarter of the 20th century is being rhymed very clearly today.
The name of the book is The Guarded Gate. Daniel Okrent, thanks so much for your time.
This has been my pleasure. Thank you, Rich.
Journalist and historian Daniel Okrent is the author of The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.